Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, part two of the teleological argument. For many more resources, go to reasonablefaith.org.
So let's look at premise two on the outline, that it's not due to law or chance. And let's first talk about whether or not the fine-tuning of the universe could be explained by law. And basically, the idea behind this alternative is that it is physically necessary that the universe be life-permitting, that the fine-tuning is due to some unknown physical law or constraint, some sort of theory of everything, which would explain why the universe is the way it is. It had to be that way, and there was really no chance, or little chance at least, of the universe not being life-permitting. Now, on the very face of it, I think this alternative is extraordinarily implausible, and that's the first sub-point I want to make about it. This alternative is saying that it is physically impossible, or virtually impossible, that the universe should be life-prohibiting, that the universe should be dead, that there would be no life in the universe. But surely that does seem to be physically possible. If the matter and antimatter in the early universe had just been a little differently proportioned, if the universe had expanded just a little more rapidly, if the entropy of the initial conditions of the universe had been slightly different, then any of these adjustments, or all of them together, would have prevented the existence of biological life in the universe. And yet all of these seem to be perfectly plausible and possible scenarios. So the person who is saying that it's physically impossible for the universe to be life-prohibiting is taking a very radical line. This person would have a very strong burden of proof to show us that this is actually the case. But there isn't any proof of that. There's no evidence at all for this first alternative. It's just put forward as a bare possibility. And while that's possible, possibilities come cheap. Possibilities come cheap. Anything is possible. The question that we're asking is, what is the best explanation for the fine-tuning of the universe? And the person who says that the best explanation is that it's physically necessary really has to give us some kind of evidence for that. We need more than just a bare assertion of a possibility. We need some kind of evidence for that, and there just isn't any. Secondly, though, there's good reasons to reject this explanation. First of all, there are these arbitrary quantities in addition to the physical constants that don't seem to be controlled by any sort of physical law. Remember, we saw 2 weeks ago that the fine-tuning concerns two types of quantity in the universe. One would be the physical constants, like the gravitational constants that are in the mathematical equations expressing the laws of nature. But in addition to those physical constants, remember, we said there are certain just arbitrary quantities that are just put in as boundary conditions on which the laws of nature operate. So even if there were some kind of laws of nature that controlled the constants, there's nothing to suggest that there's anything that controls these arbitrary quantities that are just put in as initial conditions. P.C.W. Davies is a very prominent British physicist. This is what he has to say, and I'll quote from him. Even if the laws of physics were unique, it doesn't follow that the physical universe itself is unique. The laws of physics must be augmented by some cosmic initial conditions. There is nothing, he says, in present ideas about laws of initial conditions remotely to suggest that their consistency with the laws of physics would imply uniqueness. Far from it. It seems, then, that the physical universe does not have to be the way it is. It could have been otherwise. So Davies is saying that even if the laws of physics were unique and the constants were somehow fixed, there's nothing in science about laws of initial conditions governing these. These are just arbitrary quantities that are just put in as boundary conditions. So the alternative seems, I think, highly implausible on that ground. But finally, the last point I want to make is with respect to this so-called theory of everything. It's important to understand what scientists are talking about when they talk about a theory of everything. Like so many scientific labels, this is a very misleading term. A theory of everything is not literally a theory that would explain everything, that would explain the way everything in the world is. A theory of everything is just a kind of catchy way of speaking about a unified theory of physics that would explain how the four fundamental forces of nature, gravity, electromagnetism, the atomic weak force, and the atomic strong force, are all manifestations of a single force. That these are all reducible to some single force that would be described by a theory of everything. But even once a theory of everything is discovered that explains how all four of these forces are reducible to one fundamental force, that doesn't explain all of these other examples of fine-tuning, such as the cosmological constant governing the expansion of the universe, or these arbitrary quantities like the amount of entropy that's put in at the beginning of the universe, which is just an arbitrary initial condition you begin with. So this label theory of everything is really a misnomer. It's just an attempt to explain how you can reduce the four forces of nature to one single force. It doesn't literally explain why everything is the way it is. Moreover, and this is the other point I wanted to make about these so-called theories of everything, the best candidates that we have for a theory of everything would come from a field of physics called string theory. We talked about this earlier when we talked about the Big Bang and the origin of the universe under the cosmological argument. You remember string theories are attempts to explain subatomic physics based not on ultimate particles like quarks, but rather these are reducible to little strings of energy which vibrate. And these vibrating strings of energy are the fundamental building blocks of matter that go to explain quarks and protons and other elementary particles and finally atoms and people and mountains and galaxies and everything else. So this string theory is the best candidate we have for giving us a unified theory of the fundamental forces of nature into one single force. But the point I want to make is that string theory itself, like other attempts to unify these theories, itself involves fine-tuning. So it doesn't eliminate the fine-tuning, it just pushes it back another notch. For example, in string theory, this is only formulatable in 11 dimensions. If we're to unite all of the various string theories into one type of theory that's usually called M-theory. And it requires 11 dimensions, 10 dimensions of space and one dimension of time in order to make this theory work. But there's no explanation in the theory as to why reality should have 11 dimensions. It's extraordinarily fine-tuned. I mean, out of all the dimensions there could have been, you need to have just 11. And the theory doesn't explain why there should be just 11. So at this conference Jan and I were at in Washington, D.C., I sat down for breakfast one morning with a string theorist from Baylor University. He's involved in their String Theory Institute or whatever it's called at Baylor. And we had a talk about this, and he put it very nicely. He says that string theory does not eliminate the fine-tuning. It simply replaces the present fine-tuning of the forces with geometrical fine-tuning, like 11 dimensions of time and space. So it takes on a different kind of fine-tuning. It's still fine-tuning, but now it's not force field fine-tuning. It's geometrical fine-tuning, was the way he put it. And I thought that was very helpful, very illuminating in understanding the impact of string theory upon the fine-tuning argument. And this is the pattern, as I said. The fine-tuning is incredibly stubborn. It's like a stubborn bump in the carpet. You suppress it at one point, and it only pops up someplace else. So if you eliminate the fine-tuning of, say, gravity and the weak force and so forth by unifying them into one fundamental force, well, then the fine-tuning just gets pushed back to the geometrical properties of the universe. And therefore, I think that the attempt to say that the universe has to be the way it is, that it's physically necessary that it be life-permitting, is simply implausible, and indeed there's good evidence against it. The fine-tuning isn't eliminated by these attempts to try to make it physically necessary. On the contrary, those very theories require the fine-tuning themselves so that it's not really eliminated. Okay, any questions that anybody would like to raise or discussion about this first point then, whether the fine-tuning of the universe can be best explained as being physically necessary? All right, well, then let's go on to the second alternative, which is chance. Now, according to this alternative, the fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life is just an accident. The values of the constants and the quantities all just happened to fall into the infinitesimally narrow life-permitting range, and we're the lucky beneficiaries of that. The problem, I think, with this alternative is that the odds against this happening simply by accident, by sheer chance, are so incomprehensibly great that they cannot reasonably be faced. People who just sort of blithely shrug their shoulders and say, oh, well, it could have happened by chance or the improbable happens, just don't have any understanding, I think, of the fantastic precision that is required for the fine-tuning of the universe. They would never adopt this alternative to explain some other tremendous improbability were they to encounter it. For example, if you were walking on the beach and you came across a watch lying on the sand, nobody would say, oh, well, look how the elements of the wind and the rain and the water and the sea have fallen together to produce this exquisite mechanism. And if you said to somebody who said that, well, that's extraordinarily improbable, that just would never happen. And this person says, oh, well, improbabilities happen. I mean, you wouldn't take that seriously. That's not the best explanation. So this, I think, just illustrates again the point that I made some time ago, that people, in order to avoid the inference to God, will accept explanations that they would never accept in any other area of life. Because the fine-tuning of the universe is fantastically more improbable than the fine-tuning of a simple mechanism like a watch. And so if we wouldn't accept accident in the case of a watch, neither would we or should we accept it in the case of something like the universe. But it's important to understand here that it's not just probability or improbability that's at issue here. Because it is true that fantastically improbable things do happen all the time. I mean, when you think about it, your existence is the result of a fantastically improbable event, of the union of just a certain sperm with a certain egg that produced you. And if that sperm and that egg had not met at just that time, you wouldn't exist. And yet nobody would infer from the improbability of that that therefore their union was the result of some sort of intelligent design. So it's not just improbability that's at stake here, because improbabilities do happen all the time. Rather, what is at stake here is what theorists call a specified improbability. A specified improbability. That is to say, one shows that the event in question is not only improbable, but that it also conforms to an independently given pattern. It's not only improbable, but it conforms to an independently given pattern. Let me give an example. Suppose you walked into a room and found a chimpanzee seated at a typewriter, pounding away at the keys, and you looked at what the chimpanzee had produced, and you saw it was just a string of gibberish, just random letters. Well, you would probably not think that the random letters were the result of intelligent design. It was just the result of the chimp hammering away at the keys. But suppose you walked into the room and found that one of Shakespeare's sonnets had been typed. And there was the chimp sitting in the chair next to the machine. Now, in that case, you would say something was fishy, that this sonnet had not been typed by the chimpanzee hammering away by accident at the keys of the typewriter. And yet, and here's the interesting point, the sequence of letters in the sonnet of Shakespeare and the sequence of letters in the gibberish typed by the chimp are equally improbable. They, in terms of having just that precise sequence of letters, there's no difference in the probability. The probabilities are just the same. Or think of somebody shuffling and dealing cards. If you were playing cards, any deal of the cards is equally improbable. And yet, if somebody continually dealt himself, say, a perfect bridge hand every time he dealt, you would suspect something was wrong, even though the improbability of that sequence of cards is exactly the same as the improbability of any sequence of cards dealt. So what is the difference between the two? Well, the difference is that it's not just that one is improbable and the other one is not. They're both equally improbable. The difference is that one conforms to an independently given pattern. It's a specified improbability. In the case of the chimp, the pattern of letters conforms to the independently given pattern of grammatically formed English language sentences. In the case of the bridge hand, it conforms to the pattern of the game of bridge and what constitutes a winning hand. So it is not simply that these events are improbable that tips you off that it's not the result of chance. It is the combination of improbability plus this independently given pattern to which the event conforms that tips you off that this is not the result of chance. Now, with this in mind, we can see the fallacy of people who would try to explain the fine-tuning away by saying something like this. Well, any universe is equally improbable. It's like winning the lottery. Any one person's winning the lottery is equally improbable, but somebody has to win it, assuming that all the tickets have been distributed. And therefore, if you win the lottery, you shouldn't assume that the lottery was rigged, even though it's highly improbable that you should win it. Each person's winning the lottery is equally improbable, but that doesn't therefore imply that when somebody wins it, therefore the lottery is rigged. Well, what's wrong with that analogy? Where's the fallacy in that analogy? Well, very simply, it forgets the idea of the independently specified pattern. We're not just talking about the probability of any old universe existing. We're talking about the specified probability of a life-permitting universe existing. And that is something that cries out for explanation. Any universe is equally improbable, that's true. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about the specified improbability of a life-permitting universe existing. So the correct lottery analogy for what we're talking about would be like this. It would be a lottery in which a billion, billion, billion black balls were mixed together with one white ball. And then you are commanded to reach in and pull out a single ball. If the ball is black, you will be shot. If it's white, you will be allowed to live. Now, in such a lottery, any ball you pick is equally improbable, right? No matter which ball you pick, that is equally improbable. But whichever ball you pick, it is overwhelmingly more probable that it will be black rather than white. And you need to pick the life-permitting white ball if you are to exist. So if you reach into this lottery of billions and billions and billions of black balls with one white ball, and you reach in and you pull out a ball and you see that it's white, you ought to immediately suspect that this thing is rigged, that this has not occurred by chance, because the odds are overwhelming that the ball you pick ought to be black rather than white. And that's exactly what it's like with the fine-tuning of the universe. Any universe's existence is equally improbable, that's true. But given the incomprehensible improbability of the fine-tuning of the universe which exists, whichever one it is, ought to be life-prohibiting rather than life-permitting. And if you don't see the force of the example, I find that some people don't understand probability enough to see the force of the example. Think of it this way. Suppose you had to pull out the white ball from the billions and billions of black balls, say, 5 times in a row in order to be allowed to live. And you did it 5 times in a row. Every time you reached in, you pulled out the white ball. Surely, I think all of us would say, something's wrong there. This is rigged. This shouldn't be happening by chance. And yet, the probabilities of this are not affected by having you pick 5 times rather than once. If the chances of picking the white ball or something like, say, 1 chance out of 10 to the 80th power, having you do it 5 times in a row doesn't appreciably affect the probability. So if the analogy hits you with doing it 5 times in a row, you should see the point in doing it even 1 time, given the improbability of it. So don't be fooled by people who say things like, it's like the lottery. They're misusing the analogy of the lottery. They're misunderstanding the specified improbability of picking of a life-permitting universe existing. Any comment or question about that before we go on to the next point? Do you understand the analogy that we're talking about? Yes, Steve.
When you say that any universe is equally likely to occur, or whatever you say,
yeah.
Do you mean if you don't introduce God into the equation?
Right. Yeah. Remember, we're considering here the hypothesis of chance. So we're granting the non-design person that this is just the result of chance. We're saying, okay, suppose we have a lottery and somebody just sort of throws a dart at the wall, you know, blindfolded, and it hits a universe. And that's the one that exists. That's what we're talking about here. And what we're saying is that it's incomprehensibly more probable that the dart will hit a universe that is life-prohibiting rather than life-permitting, because there are just so few life-permitting universes.
So as a Christian, you wouldn't really talk about chance at all then, would you?
No, I don't think so, because as a Christian, one would believe that the cosmos is the product of God's intelligent and providential planning. So what we're trying to do here is to eliminate the hypothesis of chance in favor of saying it's a better explanation to think that the universe was designed on purpose to be like this, rather than this just sort of took place by chance. But very often people try to defend the chance hypothesis by these lottery kinds of illustrations, and they can be persuasive until you understand that it's the wrong illustration, it's the wrong kind of lottery. And once you understand the proper kind of lottery, then you see it actually supports design. Yes, Cindy.
I failed to quite follow you when you were using the example of our coming into existence with the sperm and the egg.
Oh.
Because it seemed to me that in and of itself almost speaks to design and chance.
Yeah, I don't think so, because that's, again, kind of like the lottery illustration. Some sperm has to reach the egg.
Right.
And so whichever one does is equally improbable. granting that they all have an equal probability. I mean, in one sense, that's not really true. Some are more vigorous than others and things of that sort. But given that you've got this one egg and that there's been sexual intercourse and you've got 500,000 sperm swimming toward this egg, one of them is going to get there and fertilize it, and it's equally improbable whichever one makes it. So you wouldn't infer from the fact that this sperm got to the egg that somehow that was designed to do so rather than one of the others. Now, as Steve said, I mean, I think in a sense it is designed. I mean, I believe that God... I agree. And I'm not denying God's providence, but I'm saying that this wouldn't be a good argument for God's existence to say that, boy, my existence is so improbable that just this egg and just this sperm should have united. Therefore, there must be a God.
But life is.
I think that's true, because there I don't think it's equally improbable that life would exist. That there the probabilities are far greater that life would not exist. But with the sperm and the egg example, we're just trying to say, or the lottery example where somebody wins the lottery, we're wanting to affirm, yes, it is true that improbable things do happen all the time. Highly improbable things happen all the time. And you don't infer from that therefore something is rigged or designed just because it's improbable. But it's this combination of improbability plus the independently given pattern that tips you off that there's more than chance operating here.
Unless you're cloning.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just
yes, David.
One of the things that I run into with people who want to use the chance hypothesis is that they will begin to claim that chance caused something to happen. And what they fail to understand is chance doesn't cause anything. Chance is an expression, a way to represent mathematically what's going on. But they talk about chance as though it's some force that's pushing things along, and that's public.
That's very helpful, David. We heard a talk at the conference in Washington, D.C. I went to many of the science talks at this. And one fellow from UGA gave a talk on chaos theory. And one of the things that's pointed out is when you say something happened by chance, let's imagine event E here has happened by chance. He explained that what you really mean, you don't mean that E is an undetermined event, or that E is somehow caused by something called chance. Rather, you just mean that, say, there are two independent causal chains leading to the production of E, and that there isn't any relationship between these two chains of events. And so in that sense, it's caused by the chance coincidence of these two independent causal chains. But there isn't anything, like you say, called chance with a capital C. You just mean that these lines of causality leading to the event aren't connected with each other. So, for example, suppose you run into your friend while you're shopping at Publix by accident. That doesn't mean that chance has caused you to meet your friend at Publix, or that event is somehow undetermined. It just means that the series of causes that led you to be at Publix at that moment and the series of causes that led your friend to be at Publix at just that moment are independent of each other, that they're not coordinated. And it's in that sense that one says, we met at Publix by chance. And I found that to be very helpful. That really helped me to understand what a scientist means, say, when he says that this event happened by chance. He does not mean the event is uncaused, and he does not mean that there is some mysterious entity called chance, as David points out, that produces the event. It just means that the causal chains leading to the event aren't correlated with each other, leading to the production of that event. And so that's what we mean when we say an event happened by chance. Okay, that's helpful. Yes?
Could or would the atheist possibly take the position that, in the case of the sperm and the egg, if that particular sperm and that particular egg did not unite, then you'd be someone else Or, in the case of the universe or the cosmos, if things were slightly different, if there was a different element introduced,
yeah,
then we would have a different universe. We would possibly be another form. We would be something else.
Right, and that is correct. If the constants or the quantities were altered in some way, you would have a different universe. And remember, I talked about that a couple of weeks ago by asking us to do a thought experiment where we would make a red dot on the whiteboard representing a life-permitting universe. Let's see if this one works. Yeah, that one works better. So here's a life-permitting universe, this red dot. And then we would alter these quantities a little bit, and that makes a new universe. If it's a life-permitting one, make it a red dot. If it's life-prohibiting, then make it a blue dot. And then you repeat that procedure over and over and over and over and over and over again until finally the whole board is filled with dots. And what you discover is that you have a sea of blue with only a few pinpricks of red here and there. So you would have different universes, but they would be life prohibiting. They would be dead. There wouldn't be any life in those other universes in the absence of the fine tuning. And the question we're asking is that just by chance? Could that just have happened by chance? And what we're suggesting is that that isn't the best explanation. All right, any other question about this first point? All right, now, how can the atheist get over this problem that the specified improbability of the fine-tuning is just too great to be reasonably faced? Well, here, many thinkers have appealed to the so-called anthropic principle, which is the next point on your outline, 2.13. Now, sometimes people throw around this term, the anthropic principle, as a synonym for the argument from design. They think that the anthropic principle is a way of saying that the universe is design, but that's entirely incorrect. That's a misuse of this phrase. Rather, the anthropic principle is an attempt to explain away the fine-tuning of the universe. And to explain how it could have happened by chance. Now, what does the anthropic principle state? Well, basically it says this, that we should not be surprised to observe a finely tuned universe, because if the universe were not finely tuned, we wouldn't be here to be surprised about it. That's what the anthropic principle says. You shouldn't be surprised to observe that the universe is fine-tuned for our existence, because if it were not fine-tuned for our existence, we wouldn't be here to be surprised about it. And this is thought to, therefore, lead us to think, well, the fine-tuning of the universe requires no explanation. We shouldn't really be surprised about it. Therefore, there's nothing here to really be explained. But I think that this objection or this use of the principle is logically fallacious. The statement, we shouldn't be surprised that we do not observe conditions of the universe incompatible with our existence, is a true statement. Let me just put that up on the board. We shouldn't be surprised that we do not observe conditions incompatible with our existence. Now, that's a little bit hard to understand because it's got so many double negatives in it, but nevertheless, this, I think, is the truth that is in the anthropic principle. We shouldn't be surprised that we do not observe conditions which are incompatible with our existence. Why? Well, because if they were incompatible with our existence, we couldn't be here to observe them. And so it's hardly surprising that we don't observe conditions of the universe which are incompatible with our existence. But from this statement, it does not follow logically that we shouldn't be surprised that we do observe conditions compatible with our existence. It does not follow from this statement that we shouldn't be surprised that we do observe conditions of the universe compatible with our existence in light of the incredible improbability of those conditions existing. Given the incredible improbability of the initial conditions of the universe, we should be surprised that we do observe conditions of the universe which are compatible with our existence, even though we should not be surprised that we do not observe conditions that are incompatible with our existence. And those who push the anthropic principle are confusing this statement, which is true, indeed it's trivially true, they're confusing that statement with this statement. And that is simply a logical fallacy. This statement does not follow from that statement. That statement is true. This statement is false. Because we really should be surprised that we do observe conditions that are compatible with our existence. John Leslie, who is a Canadian philosopher who has done a lot of work on the anthropic principle, gives a very wonderful illustration of this point that I want to share with you. Leslie says, imagine that you were dragged in front of a firing squad of 100 trained marksmen, all with rifles aimed at your heart, to be executed. You hear the command given, ready, aim, fire! And you hear the deafening roar of the guns. And then you observe that you're still alive, that all of the 100 trained marksmen missed. Now, what would you conclude? Well, I guess I really shouldn't be surprised that they all missed. After all, if they hadn't all missed, I wouldn't be here to be surprised about it. Given that I am here, I should have expected them all to miss. Well, of course not. You would quite rightly conclude that while you should not be surprised that you do not observe that you're dead, because if you were dead, you couldn't observe it, you should be surprised that you do observe that you are alive in view of the enormous improbability of the marksmen all missing. You would immediately suspect that they all missed on purpose, that the whole thing was a setup engineered by some person for some reason. And it's exactly the same with the fine-tuning of the initial conditions of the universe. We shouldn't be surprised that we don't observe conditions of the universe incompatible with our existence. That would be like observing that you're dead. But it doesn't follow that we shouldn't be surprised that we do observe conditions that are compatible with our existence. That's like observing that you are alive after all of the 100 trained marksmen missed. And there you should be surprised that you do observe conditions compatible with your existence because they are so incredibly, incredibly improbable. And so the anthropic principle is simply logically fallacious. And those who use it, I think, have committed a fallacy of trying to infer this from this when they are not logically equivalent. All right, any question or discussion about the anthropic principle? Good. Did that help to make... Yeah, John Leslie's illustrations are just wonderful, and they really help to make it clear. Good. Anybody else? All right. Now, those who want to defend the alternative of chance have therefore been forced to adopt an extraordinary metaphysical hypothesis, namely the many worlds hypothesis. And that brings us to the next point, 2.14, the anthropic principle with a world ensemble. According to this hypothesis, our universe is just one member of a greater collection or ensemble of universes, all of which are real, actually existing parallel universes, not just possibilities, but realities that actually exist out there. And so this universe is not the only universe there is. There's other universes, a world ensemble, if you will, of various universes existing out there. And in order to ensure that our universe will appear by chance alone somewhere in this ensemble of universes, it is also stipulated that there is an infinite number of parallel universes. You have to say they're infinite because that's the only way you can guarantee that every possibility will be actualized. So it's not just that there's an ensemble of invisible, undetectable parallel universes. There is an infinite number of these other universes that exist out there. Moreover, these universes must all be randomly ordered with respect to their constants and their physical quantities. Because otherwise, they might all be the same. There might be an infinite number of them, but they might have all the same constants and quantities. Or they might just vary a little bit. You know, some of them have some and some have the other. Maybe there are only three values that appear in the infinite ensemble. So in order to guarantee that our universe will appear in the ensemble, you've got to postulate not just these other parallel universes, you've got to postulate an infinite number of these parallel universes, and you've got to postulate that they are all randomly ordered so that every combination of constants and quantities will occur somewhere in the world ensemble. And those who hold to this view say that therefore there will appear somewhere in the ensemble of universes a universe just like ours, and then they appeal to the anthropic principle to say we shouldn't be surprised that we observe just such a universe, because after all, if it were not finely tuned, then we wouldn't be here to observe it. Those other universes out there are dead. They don't have any observers in them, so they're not observing anything. It's only in the finely tuned one that you could have observers, and therefore we shouldn't really be surprised to observe the finely tuned conditions of the universe, because observers like us only exist in those universes that are finely tuned. And so this is the point at which the debate has been driven today. I'm entirely serious here. If you want to talk to people who are really on the cutting edge of the debate over the fine tuning of the universe, it's basically the design hypothesis versus the many worlds hypothesis. And so sober scientists are talking about this possibility in a rather desperate effort to explain away the incredible fine-tuning of the universe. So what I want to do next time when we meet, next week, is I'm going to offer a four-point critique of the mini-universe hypothesis. And I hope Joe Scotti shows up, because he's been waiting for this, you know, for many weeks now. So we're going to look at a four-point critique of the many-worlds hypothesis, and I'll argue that I think the design hypothesis is a better explanation of the fine-tuning than this randomly ordered infinite ensemble of parallel universes.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.